Hi, I'm Harford County Executive Bob Castley, and you're listening to the Maryland Association of Counties Conduit Street podcast, featuring in-depth interviews and discussions with state and county leaders on the issues that affect us all.
Hello, and welcome to the Conduit Street Podcast. My name is Sarah Sample, and I will be your host today. And we have a very exciting episode planned on an issue that has been a long time coming for Maryland, really. And we're going to discuss the Assisted Outpatient Treatment Bill that passed during the 2024 legislative session. This is House Bill 576, Senate Bill 453. So you've got those bill numbers for any other policy buffs that want to follow along on the Maryland General Assembly website, where they've got all the nitty-gritty details. To discuss this topic, we are going to the source, the architect, the primary advocate of this policy. And joining me today to discuss the new law and what this means for Marylanders, we have Marie Grant. Marie is the Assistant Secretary for Health Policy at the Maryland Department of Health. Welcome, Marie, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Well, so before we dive into the bill, go ahead and tell our listeners a little bit about your role generally at the health department.
Sure. Thank you. So my title is Assistant Secretary for Health Policy at the Maryland Department of Health, and I work on all things government affairs, legislation, regulations, communications, and policy. So it's a really exciting role at an exciting time, and I view it as all things healthcare advocacy at the department.
Awesome. And so, and this is not your first foray into this work or this division. You were here before, right?
Yes. So I was actually the Director of Government Affairs at the Maryland Department of Health under the O'Malley Brown administration from 2011 to 2013. And then I actually started my career as a nonpartisan a policy analyst and legislative counsel at the Maryland Department of Legislative Services.
So you're no stranger to this environment then, because our podcast listeners always hear the policy team here talking about the 90-day session and the really long days and all of the work groups and the committees and the testimony. This is, you're sort of a natural at this by this point, right?
This is, I definitely understand this world and its logic as much as one can. It's never a dull moment.
That's a good way of putting it. All right. Well, so then diving into the bill, this is a bill that was considered heavily last year and pretty quickly after it didn't pass during the 2023 session. I remember seeing that the Maryland Department of Health came out with a fairly strong statement saying that you wanted to consider this thoughtfully in the interim. And so maybe tell listeners a little bit about what that process was like and how did this rise to the top of the list as a state agency priority?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. So maybe just as a little bit of a backdrop, I think last year in the 2023 legislative session, there was a tremendous amount of work, particularly in the House Health and Government Operations Committee to work on this bill. But it's been a bill that has been introduced in various forms and caused a lot of debate. At least over the past 10 years, if not longer. I think actually a version of it was probably introduced and heard when I was at the Department of Health before. And just as some perspective as well, I think our number one priority here under Secretary Herrera Scott's leadership is to look at behavioral health and really strengthen our continuum of care. Across the spectrum. So that means everything from prevention and primary behavioral health care services, all the way to different treatment options for folks with a serious mental illness. And I think the 2023 legislative session was obviously the first session for our new governor and lieutenant governor, first session for the Secretary of Health. And so I think everyone was still getting their sea legs under them But we quickly realized that this needed to be an important discussion. It was really important to strengthening that overall continuum of care for behavioral health.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I remember when I saw that notice came out from MDH after the session had ended, that I was really happy to hear that, because this was something the counties were very supportive of. And not just MAKO as an organization, but a lot of our professional affiliates really do see the value and the benefit in this, and just how across the behavioral health spectrum in the community, it really has a broad reach in terms of the way individuals in need are interacting with the state and the local agencies. So we were really excited to hear that. And some of the background that you just shared, I didn't even realize that some of the legislation or the proposed legislation went back that far. So that's good to at least see.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, all right. So maybe let's ground this for listeners before we get too much into the nitty gritty details. So maybe tell us a little bit about what's the real world problem we're trying to solve with this legislation, with assisted outpatient treatment.
Right. So the real world problem is that there's a small number of folks out there with serious mental illness who because of their illness aren't able to comply with the treatment that's been prescribed to them by a psychiatrist. And what that means then in practicality is that these folks may struggle and may run into our system in a couple of different ways, which is just frankly not good for them and not good for their health and not good for their mental health. One way, if folks aren't receiving treatment for their condition and aren't able to comply with treatment, they may wind up in our hospitals or state hospitals and need to be hospitalized involuntarily. Another thing that can happen is that these folks may hit our criminal justice system when what they really need is actually treatment and a way to help structure that treatment for them so that they're able to comply with the treatment protocols. And that's really what we're trying to solve here, is these folks who not just have serious mental illness, but aren't able to comply with their treatment programs because of their illness.
Yeah. And I would say, I think one of the things you mentioned in terms of interactions with the justice system, I think that's how it initially got on my radar, was talking with some of our detention centers and our wardens. And, you know, when one of these individuals does end up in one of the facilities, you know, an experience like going into a detention center for someone like you've just described that can really benefit from this program, that's an environment that, I mean, you can be a detention center that's doing everything right, but that's an environment that can really exacerbate the symptoms that the individual is experiencing. And end up, you know, doing more harm than good. And then that's another tricky thing with the local detention centers is, you know, this is someone who needs really serious medical care. And that's not something that we typically have in local detention centers. And so that's initially how it came up on my radar. And so if something like this is able to affect this process further upstream so that they don't end up in that situation, I think that's good across the board. Detention centers, and the hospital centers and some of the health departments that are trying to do some of this work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why, to your point, this year we really saw lots of folks support this legislation. Obviously the MAKO, which was just fantastic, and we are so grateful for that support. Our hospital systems, the medical community, just a lot of folks really saw the need for this option as an option that we need to have in the state of Maryland.
Definitely. Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. The vision at this point, I think, was there across the board. So I think that's definitely an element that helped drive it for sure. But so then in terms of how this process plays out, so the process starts with a petition to the court, right? Is that sort of what the catalyst would be?
Yes, absolutely. And even just to back up for a second, this is really, again, for folks with serious and persistent mental illness who are not complying with their medication and it's having adverse impacts on their lives. And so the process does start with the filing of a petition with the circuit court. And it can be filed by anyone who has a legitimate interest in the welfare of the respondent. So that could be like a family member. It could be a healthcare provider. But that petition has to include a number of really important attestations, including that that the person does have serious and persistent mental illness, and that that serious and persistent mental illness has resulted in essentially bad consequences recently. Yeah. Like it has to have necessitated inpatient hospital admissions recently, or it may have resulted in an act of serious violent behavior towards self or others, or patterns of threats.
Got it. So essentially it could be a family member or someone with an interest in this person's well-being, and they're seeing this pattern. So it sounds like that's sort of what the court is going to consider, is the pattern of behavior that's leading to these poor outcomes for the individual.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in addition to it's just there's this pattern of behavior that's resulted, but then also that this form of treatment, that assisted outpatient treatment, is necessary in order to prevent a relapse or deterioration. And also finally, that someone is unlikely to adequately adhere to their current treatment on a voluntary basis. And again, based on that history. There's one of the things that was really important for us as well as the General Assembly, is that history of not adhering to treatment, it can't be due to financial, transportation, or language issues. Like, it really has to be due to the mental illness itself and not any social determinants of health that person might be facing.
Got it. So a bit of a safeguard there then.
Yeah, absolutely.
So with it being then a court procedure, how does representation work in this setting?
One of the important protections here is that the public defender's office is required to represent folks who may be faced with this proceeding. That doesn't mean that folks who have a petition filed about their treatment, that doesn't mean that they can't get their own lawyer, but it does mean that the public defender's office will be there for them to help rigorously represent them.
Right. So if private counsel is cost restricted for them, they won't be left on their own. They would have someone from the state step in and help out.
Absolutely.
Got it. Okay. So then we go through the court process and it's heard by a judge. Is it a judge that's hearing it?
It is. But actually, before we even get to the judge, one of the really important things about this process and what really makes it, I think, therapeutic is once that petition gets filed with the court, and this is where an assisted outpatient treatment program comes in, a care coordination team needs to develop a treatment plan for this individual. And that treatment plan has to meet certain requirements that are in the legislation. It needs to be recovery oriented, needs to be consistent with evidence-based and evolving best practices. For each service listed, there needs to be a reference to a provider that's going to do that service. And everyone involved needs to have a reasonable opportunity to participate in the development of that treatment plan.
And so does that happen after the petition is confirmed, or does that happen as soon as the petition is filed?
Happens as soon as that process starts as soon as the petition is filed.
Oh,
and then
wow.
Another thing that's part of that process is that a respondent has the opportunity to voluntarily agree to that treatment plan. And what happens then if there's voluntary agreement to the treatment plan? The care coordination team then notifies the court that the case is dismissed and there's a stipulated agreement, including the treatment plan in place.
Oh, wow. So there's potential to head off the further court procedure that would just add more work on the court side of it, because the care coordination team activates as soon as the petition is done. There's potential for them to comply immediately before they go into a longer court process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And we really think that that's going to be most of the cases there's a really similar process in California's assisted outpatient treatment legislation, and the vast majority of folks end up just voluntarily agreeing before it really hits the judge.
And that's what I think I've heard referenced a couple times just in hearing the testimony on this bill, is that sort of black robe effect. So it's almost, it has that effect even before you would even get to the point of needing to be seen in front of the judge, because it's just sort of, it's a really powerful deterrent, I guess.
I think it's a deterrent, but another way, and I think how we're looking at it, it's also just really a connector. Yeah. At the end of the day, I think it's a really powerful connector to folks to really help make sure that they are getting the treatment that they need and that they have access to it. I think that's really our hope. I think as we've talked about it, it really is a program that's about access to treatment at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Well, so, and when it comes to access to treatment, you mentioned the care coordination team. Can you tell us a little bit about who does that team consist of? Like what agencies are we looking at?
That's a great question. I think, so there are certain requirements for who needs to be on the care coordination team. It needs to consist of, at minimum, a psychiatrist, a case manager, a certified peer recovery specialist, or any other treating providers that may be clinically appropriate. And there's also a process in the legislation where the department is going to set up further clinical requirements for that team. But then to your question of who is actually operating the team, it can be under the auspices of either the state or the counties. So there is the option for counties, if they want to operate their own programs, to let us know that at the department before January 1, 2025. And in that case, the counties and their local behavioral health authorities would be setting up the care coordination teams as needed. But in counties that don't want to set up their own programs, then that would defer to the state and the Maryland Department of Health.
Right. And I remember when we were considering the bill, that was something that we thought was a really considerate element in terms of the way that the bill is drafted, that it's authorizing for the jurisdictions that are able to do something like this, but that there's still this fallback that the state agency can go ahead and step in and do it if, you know, with resources and staffing issues, the way that I know the entire public sector has been dealing with. I think that, yeah, having that option to do it if you can do it, but then still having the service being provided through the state, I think we were really happy to see that, because it was considerate of the challenges that each jurisdiction is facing locally, that's just a little bit different from each other. You've got some people that have a lot more resources and a lot more staff, and other jurisdictions that are in a different situation. So that was something that I know we really appreciated in terms of the language, for sure.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that. I think we definitely felt the same way. I think where counties are able and want to operate these programs, we certainly want to encourage that. But then, you know, I think the state being willing to operate this as well is really a statement too of how much we believe in the importance of setting up this program statewide.
Yeah, and I think that setting it up that way in the bill, the way it was done this year, is a little different than how it had been done in the past, where I think it was sort of, it was an option, but there was no requirement necessarily for anyone else to do it if a local jurisdiction wasn't going to do it. And I think when we're talking about a court process that is about making sure that an individual has more access to the treatment methods that they need for their well-being, that it would just be strange if you had one jurisdiction doing it, but then you didn't have that same thing available in another jurisdiction, when this is a court procedure that's about equitable access and the well-being of an individual who's in this situation. So I thought the distinction between last year's bill as an option and this year's bill as authorizing, but then still required to be fulfilled by the state, I thought that was a great, just in terms of being able to catch all the people that are potentially going to be in need and that we know are in need right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then that brings another thing to mind, is that the way that you guys did the authorization, it was so that you could have some jurisdictions collaborate with others as a way to sort of like pool resources together to get it established.
Yep, that's absolutely the case. And frankly, our hope too, if there are counties that want to come together and cover a region.
So there were just so many elements like that I think made it so from the start, we really wanted to help and see what we could do to get this one over the finish line. Because yeah, there were just a lot of these considerations that I think took the needs of and the varying needs of the different jurisdictions into account. And I think that just felt like really great collaboration and really great policy in terms of wanting something that's going to be effective across the board.
Absolutely.
So then when it comes to the treatment, so obviously treatment costs money. What is sort of the treatment cost layout for something like this? If you have someone who might not be able to afford the certain types of medications or certain types of appointments, but they're still required by the law to comply. What does that sort of look like in terms of an indigent individual who might not be able to afford the treatment, or even someone who does have coverage? Like, what can you tell us a little bit about sort of what does the insurance coverage landscape look like in terms of something like this?
Yeah, so we really do a couple of things. We do anticipate that most of these folks are probably going to be eligible for Medicaid, and that Medicaid would in fact cover these services. To the extent that there's a private insurance payer involved, we also think that, again, most of these services are probably going to be covered under an insurance plan, if not all, because of medical necessity requirements that private payers need to comply with. And then I think finally, for folks who truly don't have coverage and may not be eligible for coverage, eligible for Medicaid, for those few folks, I think that we will need to work through this. I hesitate to just say broad brush that we'll fund that. But at the end of the day, this is an important program. And so I anticipate that we would really look at folks who would be in that situation and want to make sure that they're covered. Because at the end of the day, this is a treatment program. We want to make sure folks get the treatment that they need.
Yeah.
That all being said, Sarah, I think there's many studies, including one that really struck us from California, that said for every dollar that's spent on an AOT program, the government saves $1.80. So over time, and that's because folks may not be hitting the hospital, they may not be hitting the criminal justice system, they're getting treatment in a much more appropriate setting, and in a lower cost setting. So ultimately, this does end up to be a saver. So there is a delayed effective date for the bill to July 1, 25, and then the actual programs don't need to be implemented fully until July 1, 26. So that's really going to give all of us the time to work through some of those knotty questions and to see if there are additional appropriations that are going to be needed beyond the initial appropriation that we have of $3 million for planning.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that sort of like net effect gets talked about in a lot of different types of legislation. But I mean, at least from the county perspective, particularly the detention centers, when it comes to the cost saving element and the depleting of resources in different areas where those aren't even the exact kind of resources that this individual needs, for instance, if they end up in a detention center. That was something that was immediately apparent to, I know, a few of our organizations like the chiefs and sheriffs, the health officers, the detention centers. It is real savings when it comes to this kind of a program. And you want to make sure that the resources that we do have available are meant to be used for the appropriate care for the appropriate individuals rather than being used in a situation where they're not necessarily intended for this person, but we're just trying to do the best that we can. And that doesn't feel great. And it's not good for the detention center, let's say, and their staff. And it's not good for the individual. And so that was something that I think was immediately obvious to us, is that this will just be two-pronged in terms of getting the individual the care that's going to be effective for them, but also not deplete resources that are meant to be used for a different subset of the population, essentially.
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely. So then someone has had a petition made. They have initially complied. A treatment plan has been put together. This is the question that I know kept coming up a lot during session, and it's sort of, what happens if the individual did not comply with the treatment plan? What's sort of the avenue at that point, or avenues?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right. It really caused a lot of debate in the session. Let me just say that there are many, many protections for individuals in this bill. First of all, these cases, they're private matters. The petitions must be held under seal and can't be publicized. A court can't issue a finding of contempt or for involuntary hospitalization for failure to comply with an AOT order or a treatment plan. And participation in AOT can't be used against an individual in a subsequent legal matter that carries negative collateral consequences. All of those things coming together, what that means is that in the first case where someone voluntarily agrees to a treatment plan and the case is dismissed and there's a stipulated agreement, if for some reason there's evidence that that person is not complying with the voluntary treatment plan over time, the stipulated agreement does give the judge authority to sort of call folks back into court if there's evidence that that's happening and have a hearing. Similarly, if there's an order, an AOT order, if the case goes down that far and someone is not complying, a judge can call the parties back in for a hearing to discuss progress. And to your point, I think that's where perhaps even just, you know, the venue of calling someone in and realizing the seriousness of the matter may help. But at the end of the day, there's no contempt order there. There's no force. And the other important thing to note is that under this bill, an AOT order can only last up to a year and is not renewable. So again, the hope is really that getting folks in the door in this way will help set them on a great path and give them additional supports take their medication for the future. But this is sometimes people unfortunately refer to assisted outpatient treatment as forced treatment. And I think in this case, there's really not an element of force. There are a lot of protections in this legislation.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing too, is that I think something that I've read a little bit about is that you do have some programs designed like this, where it's more about access to the voluntary option than it is about forcing anything. But we're also seeing in a lot of other states that these programs are working. I know all the programs look a little bit different, but maybe tell us a little bit about what those success rates look like elsewhere. And actually, are we really the 49th state on the list to do this? Is that that real?
I think we're 48.
Oh, my goodness. Usually, I mean, you always see Maryland wanting to get out in front and be like the top five states that did something. And I saw that and I'm like, wow, how's that gonna happen?
Yeah, I think yes. So we are the 48th state. 47 other states do have some form of this of an assisted outpatient treatment program. And to your point, they all look a little different, and have different criteria. But really, we are the 48th. And I think it's taken us so long to get here, Sarah, and I'm very sympathetic to, exactly because of that concern over people's rights.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there really just has been this real concern by our advocates to want to make sure and by our legislators, by our policymakers, that to want to make sure that folks' rights are protected. And I think at the end of the day, this legislation does a really great job of creating a treatment program, but also making sure that folks' rights are protected.
Yeah, you know, and I would also add to that that I think having it take a little bit longer and having other programs to look at, but also having that number of questions that people want to have answered, I think ultimately ends up providing a better service. But it's so much of it is about education too. I think when someone is first looking into something like this, maybe you're an elected official or one of the other stakeholders, it's a big dynamic kind of thing, and there are a lot of questions. And so I think that process of making sure that the questions are getting answered, but also people are getting educated along the way so that when we get to rollout and implementation, the wealth of knowledge that is out there is better, it's more accurate, it's more robust. And I think that serves the end goal even better. So sometimes taking a little bit longer doesn't, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, so then getting a bill like this through, a big and important bill through the General Assembly is absolutely not an easy task. So when it comes to this bill moving through, all the legislative hoops and hurdles, sometimes those hoops and hurdles are on fire. How did it go for you guys? Like, do you feel like, I mean, it looks like it did pretty much take the full legislative session, to get through it all, but like, what was that process like for you? Do you feel like stakeholders were coming to the table to be productive, or people just trying to close it down? Yeah, how did that process go?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think again, here's where I need to really give a shout out to Chair Pena Melnick, the Health and Government Operations Committee,
Yes.
Delegate Bagnall and Delegate Alston. And unfortunately, I'm probably leaving some folks off the list, who I hope will forgive me. But there was a work group that the committee held in the 2023 session. And they really spent a lot of time bringing stakeholders from all sides of the issue to come together and talk through the issues. And I think that like we really benefited from that, and that helped to carry some momentum in the to the 2024 session. We did make some further changes. The bill had a slightly different posture, as you mentioned, beyond just being a county option. We really wanted to make sure there was a statewide program. But I think at the end of the day, this is a big bill. It's a complex bill. And we and the administration, June Chung, Deputy Legislative Officer, the Secretary of Health, Laura Herrera Scott, really spent just a lot of time talking through with legislators individually about the need for the program, had the opportunity to just answer a lot of their questions to the extent that we needed to address concerns and amendments, which we were, I think, even up until the final week of session, helped to work on some additional amendments in finance that in Senate finance that really made the bill better. I think that spending that time and having those conversations and really hearing folks out were what were critical to the success of the bill. And I also just want to the Senate Finance Committee was really wonderful to work with, you know, in getting this bill out. Chair Beidle and Vice Chair Klossmeyer also, and other members of the committee really spent time to wrestle with the bill and again make it better.
Yeah, I know, and I actually remember I think watching the hearing, or maybe it was the voting session, probably both, when it got over to the Senate, and it was getting later in session. There were a lot of questions and a lot of legislators wanting to still add certain things or tweak certain things. And I remember having that moment of like, oh no, like addressing this many things like this close to the finish line, it can be really difficult. But I think the fact that that didn't hold it up with just a nod to some of what you've already discussed is that just that level of coordination and collaboration between sort of the administration, the elected officials that are sitting on these committees and have an interest in this, the agency, so MDH, I think all of that sort of like collaboration made it so when it comes to having something urgent that needs to happen quickly, you're able to get it done a lot faster, I think, because you've got a lot of advocates and you've got a lot of really smart people who are able to answer questions and continue making the ball move forward. And I would even, you know, back to your point about Chair Pena Melnick, I remember I'd be sitting in the hearing room, and if something came up that was a question about this or a concern, I remember Chair Panyamelnik was like, "You're going to go talk to Marie right now. You're going to get this dealt with." And so, like, adding that urgency to it, you know, saying just go out in the hallway and deal with this, made it so like it couldn't get slowed down. Really, it made it so the ball was continuing to move forward. And I think, yeah, just that trust in the collaboration and the care for the mission overall, I think, was pretty awesome to watch. I would say.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It was really, I think overall it took all session to your point, but it really, I think it was worth it. It made it a better bill.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that I really appreciate about this issue is, this is a bipartisan issue, right? It really had bipartisan support, across the board. I think folks understand the importance of this issue and really work together to move it forward.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I would say, you know, one other thing that, you know, I've, you know, made a point of just at, you know, at MACO as an organization working with our affiliates is that I think sometimes, and it's not just at MACO, I think it, with other agencies and stakeholders, sometimes we're focusing a little bit more on worrying about the things that we are against. And sometimes I think your position is more credible and more valuable if we go out and get in front of the things that we also think are really great ideas and that we want to support. And sometimes with the bandwidth during session, you don't always have as much time to do that. And I know that this was one where, again, when it came to the chiefs and sheriffs, the health officers, the wardens and the detention centers, the MACO legislative committee, everybody wanted to make sure that our voice was heard in terms of this is a good idea. This is something that actually can help. So while there are some of those things that we're still concerned about that are problematic, this is something that we can say we can all be on the same team on this and we can try to help, you know, put our voice behind this and support it so that people know how valuable and important this is.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. All right. Well, so this is, you know, groundbreaking legislation here in Maryland. And I will say that it is common for the General Assembly to go through a few, I wouldn't say drafts because this one's already passed, but I'd say a few modifications in the years after passage, but also sort of leading into implementation. I think we've definitely seen that with bills like the Time to Care Act. As a recent example, I think this past session was the third round of modifications for it. So, like for this particular bill for assisted outpatient treatment, how close do you think it is to the final product? And are there any elements that were heavily debated and didn't make it in that the department or other stakeholders might want to go back for and add clarity in the 2025 session or beyond? Or do you feel like this is pretty close to the final draft?
So, also a great question. I think from the department's perspective, this is pretty close to a final draft in the sense that it was so heavily negotiated.
Yeah,
was really discussed a lot, and I think we're in the place where we feel like this is a really good bill and a great start. But to your point, I think. This is also a bill where folks have a number of different opinions on what will be most effective. And I think also the good news is that there's extensive data collection that's required as part of the bill. And so I think as we move into implementation, we're going to be really open to working with the General Assembly, working with our stakeholders on seeing what's working, right? Like if there are things that we need to either strengthen or loosen, depending on how the program is implemented, we'll want to be open to that discussion.
Well, that's great to hear. Yeah. And that was sort of my next thought is that this, for the listeners, this is part one of what is going to be a two-part series on the assisted outpatient treatment. And so what we've been talking about mostly today is really what the bill entails and sort of what are the parameters and how the process is intended to work. But Marie, you're going to join us again for a podcast about implementation and regulations and all kinds of things like that, that basically how we make the rubber meet the road with this bill. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And my hope is, well, the governor will need to sign it first, of course. But
that little thing.
yes, there's that. But yes, I think we really look forward to working with our counties, with our health officers and our behavioral health authorities on implementation, and look forward to discussing with you more about that at a later date.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I know we worked so much together during session that, like, I was seeing you almost every day and talking to you pretty often. And then it's all of a sudden session stops and it's like everyone just needs a breather. So it's so great to be connecting back with you for the interim. Because, I think I was missing you a little bit.
Likewise. I know I never quite get used to session ending at midnight and then just everything falling away. But you know how to find me, and look forward to continued conversations on this and other issues that are important for me.
And I would even just add, that's something that, certainly counties and our members appreciate, is that you have been so accessible and so forthcoming, even when we are sharing things with each other that we know the other one might not like. It's still a part of the conversation, is still important, it's still respectful. And I think that's not the case in all relationships. So from a county perspective, we certainly appreciate that. And then we certainly consider the interim a great time to get work done too. So we'll definitely be in touch, even though it's not session. But speaking of the interim, session is really intense. And what do you do after the 90 days to just sort of recharge? You go into Bali or a mountain somewhere? What do you have planned?
So immediately after session, I did actually take a week off, and I did not go anywhere fancy. I actually just used the time to reconnect with my family and do things like clean my house, boring things, but really just to like reset and recharge. But looking forward to some trips this summer, for sure.
Well, family time and just cleaning the house, that is definitely some primary self-care topics right there, for sure. So that sounds lovely. All right. Well, so thank you for joining us today. Just a final public service announcement to our audience members. The summer conference registration is open. This is for the MACO Summer Conference. The theme is Turning the Tide, and it will be held at the Roland Powell Center, Convention Center, in Ocean City, Maryland, and it'll be August 14th through August 17th. So go to the website, get yourself registered, get yourself a hotel room, and come ready for a week of enrichment and really a lot of relationship building with agencies and colleagues across the state. Marie, are you going to join us there?
I will see you there.
Absolutely. Great. Well, so as always, listeners, we love that you join us each week for the Conduit Street podcast. And you can show that you love even more by subscribing and reviewing our podcast on the podcasting platform of your choice. And if you found an episode uniquely compelling, obviously like the one today, please go ahead and share it far and wide from the Conduit Street Facebook page and the X page, formerly Twitter. And so for Marie Grant, I am Sarah Sample. And we will talk to you soon.